Veteran Podcast. Thank you for your service.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to Bulletproof Veteran Podcast. If you know me, you know that I love World War II history. I used to sit with my grandfather at his house and listen to him talk about World War II and every book that he was reading at the time. He used to ride his bicycle up to the library and fill a basket full of World War II history books. Now, he was in the Pacific during World War II. He was an anti-aircraft gunner in Hawaii and in Guam. And I would listen to stories all day long. Every day after elementary school, I would go to his house and listen. All the way up until the year that he passed away, that Christmas, we were sitting on my couch. He wasn't feeling too good. And he was still telling me stories about World War II. And it spawned a love of that generation and just the intricacies and political weirdness and the heroes that came out of that era that really shaped our country and created, for me, created the United States and what we look at now and what I hold as the principles of the United States. So when I had the opportunity to talk about that on the show, I had to jump at it. So today on the show, we're going to be talking to Dale Jenkins. He is a Navy officer, a retired Navy officer, who served in the 1960s, served through the Cuban Missile Crisis, but he studied history, and he studied the diplomacy during World War II, and that's why he decided to write his book that is Diplomats and Admirals. It's coming out in December, but pre-orders start as soon as November 1st on Amazon, so we'll be getting everybody over there to get this book, especially if you love history and kind of the intricacies and learning from what happened to where we are today and why we need to pay attention. So, Dale, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's great to be here. Great to be participating with you and your organization.
I appreciate it, sir. And like we always do on the show, we like to hear a little bit about the person, you know, the author or whoever has their organization or whatever, because I guess that shapes probably how they make their kind of opinions and decisions on what they're doing. So I'd love to hear a little bit about yourself. You have a storied history, including Harvard and Columbia and a lot of other things. So please tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was an ROTC student at, when I was in college, Navy ROTC. So as a result of that, I was commissioned. I served for 3 years in the Navy. Most of that was on a destroyer in the Pacific. And so I got to see the places that were the scenes of the battles, scenes of the action in World War II. Thing about naval battles is that there's a big battle and a day later you can go by and it's all just open ocean. You don't see battlefields as such. And as such, and because of that, naval battles tend to be understated. They tend to be forgotten. They tend to lack the somehow tangible credibility that land battles have. And Midway, Coral Sea, the other actions have tended to be overlooked because of this. And it's not generally recognized that for the better part of a year after we were in World War II, it was entirely a naval war. Mm-hmm. No way to land any troops anywhere until August of 1942, when the Marines went ashore in Guadalcanal. And even after that, the Marines were fighting in a slugfest with the Japanese troops on Guadalcanal that went on for 6 months. But while that was happening, there were six, possibly seven major naval engagements offshore Guadalcanal, where the Japanese lost about 25 ships. We lost about 25 ships. And it took those engagements to finally win the Guadalcanal campaign. So by that time, we were in 1943. We executed a landing on Morocco later in 1942, and that really was bogged down until 1943 there, when we finally went into Sicily. So for all that period of time, our involvement in World War II was one of the United States Navy in the Pacific and also in the Atlantic, fighting U-boats in the Atlantic. These are the things that have been overlooked to a very large extent.
And Midway was really where we showed off our dominance in the air as well. If you look at Midway, the naval aviation, I mean, that was a demonstration of how powerful the United States Navy aviation was, from taking out ships to air-to-sea combat and all of that.
Well, it was, and we achieved the turning point in the Pacific War at Midway, which was, of course, part of the entire naval battle that went on through most of 1942.
So let's back up a little bit, because Midway is kind of towards the end of your book, but your book starts well before Pearl Harbor and the lead up to Pearl Harbor and what we may have done wrong, right, indifferent, but the steps that led us to Pearl Harbor. So Take us to the start of World War II. What was happening in Japan, the expansion of Japan, and what led to some of the decisions of how we got to Pearl Harbor?
Well, Japan, as we know, it had expanded. They had expanded over really 50 years. They had taken over Korea. They had taken over Taiwan. They had taken over portions of Manchuria. This was really a Japanese empire, and they meanwhile had built up their navy. And they continued with the war in China. They were bogged down in China. By 1941, it had been going on for 4 years. They were looking for a way out. But meanwhile, to cut off supplies coming into China, they expanded into Indochina, first in 1940 with the northern portion of Indochina. And then in July of 41, they went into the southern portion of Indochina, which is now, of course, Vietnam. Some of the same names Cam Ranh Bay, for example, that we came to know. But when they went to southern Indochina, Roosevelt said, "This is enough. We got to do something to stop this." And he did this knowing that Hitler was the major threat. Mm-hmm. The European scene, the European army was the major threat. Hitler was powerful. Japan had limited capabilities. And so the idea was, let's not do anything with Japan because we don't want a war with Japan. We want to be able to maintain our power, and while our power was building, to counter the threat of Hitler. So Roosevelt put a limited oil embargo, which was really freezing Japanese assets in the U.S., so they couldn't buy oil. And this was a limited imposition on their assets, which was designed to create a negotiation, and if possible, stop any further expansion, and if possible, get them to withdraw from southern Indochina. And it was supposed to be a way of initiating serious negotiations with the Japanese. Mm-hmm. What happened was that Dean Acheson, who was the Assistant Secretary of State, a tough lawyer, had been in legal practice for 20 years, he imposed a total freeze on Japanese assets. There were no exports of any oil to Japan. And because Japan had imported about 90% of its oil from other parties, and 90% of that came from the United States, This put Japan into a crisis. And they threatened war because the only way they were going to get war at that point was to go into the Dutch East Indies, Borneo, Java, and so forth, to get oil.
And what was FDR's stand on the Secretary of State doing this? I mean, FDR started with the partial oil embargo. It's quite an escalation to go to the full oil embargo when you're trying to draw somebody out for discussion.
That's right.
Where was FDR in that?
Atchison did this while Roosevelt was meeting with Churchill in Newfoundland.
Okay.
This is July, August 1941. Roosevelt came back, saw what had been done, but he was concerned about appearing to appease Japan. Appeasement was a dirty word because of the Munich appeasement of Hitler. So there was a very serious concern about doing anything that appeased Japan. And the strategy became one of trying to do a limited amount of appeasement with Japan, at the same time looking for some way of having an agreement.
Okay.
And this drifted on through the fall of 1941. The Japanese diplomats were desperately looking for an agreement with the U.S. There was an agreement in place in November of 41 where the Japanese agreed to pull out of southern Indochina in exchange for a resumption of oil shipment. And this was codified in a modus vivendi dated November 22nd, 1941. This was in writing. Secretary of State Cordell Hull circulated this around to the British, the Dutch, and the Chinese. The British were concerned about a one-on-one agreement with Japan because it could have left Singapore still exposed. The Chinese came back with an adamant, forceful demand that we not have an agreement with Japan. They wanted us on in the war supporting them.
And that was Chiang Kai-shek at the time.
That was Chiang Kai-shek.
Yeah.
And it's in my book, the documented statement by Chiang Kai-shek, which is now part of the diplomatic papers of the United States. Anybody could look it up.
Mm-hmm.
And quoted word for word in the book. And he said, if there's any relaxation of the embargo on oil, we will consider this, words in effect, a refutation of our relationship and of our alliance. And the result of this will not be to China alone, which is a thinly veiled threat against the United States. Cordell Hull was confused as to what to do. He thought, what do I do now? I can't possibly do anything that violates our relationship with China, which I think was a terrible mistake. We were not obligated to agree with China on anything because their interests were different than ours.
Of course.
He substituted a second, which was really a long-term goal document, which provided for Japan to withdraw entirely from Indochina, entirely from China, and refute the tripartite pact, which they had gotten into, which was really a dead letter at that point. There was no real relationship with Germany anymore because Germany had invaded Russia, and there was no way that they were going to interact in any meaningful way. To recognize Chiang Kai-shek as the only legitimate government in China, and there was no mention of any resumption of oil.
Hmm.
So when this went back to Tokyo, there was a conference, and they looked at this and they said, we now realize that there is no diplomatic agreement with the United States. And the word went out to the six carrier fleet, proceed with the attack on Pearl Harbor.
So, you know, you look at it. So it was, if I have it correct, Admiral Yamamoto and FDR basically had this agreement that we're going to.
It wasn't between Yamamoto and.
It wasn't Yamamoto. Who was? So the agreement was just between the Japanese and the Americans at a higher level.
Yeah, it was on a diplomatic level.
It was on a diplomatic level. Okay.
I feature Yamamoto because he was the continuing naval power.
Okay.
In Japan. It's a little bit different than diplomatic power, but Yamamoto was there. He was building the fleet. Mm-hmm. And when war broke out, he was the one that was in command of the fleet.
Okay. But they had this agreement that at the time would have allowed the United States to focus on Hitler, which needed to be done,
yes,
and would have kept us out of a war in the Pacific. And at the
yes
same time, would have kind of told China, hey, we don't have the same interests. Like we have to do what's best for us and not. I mean, we're not going to appease Japan, but in turn, we're appeasing China, which now leads us into Pearl Harbor. I mean, it's kind of crazy when you think about it.
Well, there was a 3-day period or a 4-day period when we were at war only with Japan.
Yes. Yep. From the 8th to the 11th.
This was just the opposite of the strategy that they were pursuing. FDR had really come to the conclusion that Europe could not survive on their own against Hitler. And sooner or later, we were going to have to get into that war. But the isolationists who saw the disasters resulting from World War I, mm-hmm, and here we were in another war ready for another war with Germany. What was the point of the whole involvement in World War I? They were very powerful. And so FDR couldn't really violate the power that they had without serious repercussions. So he had established Lend-Lease with Britain, established Lend-Lease with Russia, established Lend-Lease with China, but we were not ready for a war. We actually had an undeclared war in the Atlantic with our destroyers fighting German submarines, mm-hmm, without Germany or United States declaring war. This is about as far as he could go without getting into serious trouble with the isolationists and at the same time gearing up for what he thought was inevitably going to be a war with Hitler.
So is there any idea that Hitler was also talking to Japan, and what would have his point of view been to coax them into attacking Pearl Harbor, or maybe telling them not to let America stay out of it? Was there any kind of back and forth in that regard to the days leading up to it? Because I know there was communication prior between Germany and Japan.
Yeah, there had been,
mm-hmm,
and it really fell off after,
okay,
Hitler invaded Russia.
Okay.
But by December, the Russian army had mobilized themselves. And there's a very interesting chapter in my book about there was a spy in Tokyo who was actually German. But he had become a communist sympathizer, and he was operating in Tokyo. His name was Sorge, S-O-R-G-E, one of the most brilliant, probably the most brilliant spy in the entire war. He was dodging the secret services of Japan, Germany, and Russia. But he convinced Stalin that the Japanese were not going to invade Manchuria, which allowed Stalin to bring back most of the Siberian army to defend Moscow. Just a brilliant piece of spying success. And in by December, that Siberian army was back defending Moscow, and it prevented the Germans from taking Moscow. And so Hitler realized that he was not going to take Moscow, at least in the very near future, that the attack against Moscow was bogged down. So when the attack against Pearl Harbor went ahead, Hitler saw this as an opportunity to get together back with the Axis forces, and he declared war on the United States as a way of bolstering support in Japan for the war against the United States. It's his way of establishing, like you might say, a two-ocean war the United States was then involved in, which was not where we wanted to be, but was where we found ourselves after December 7th and the attack on Pearl Harbor.
So, yeah, it's amazing, because I'm as you're talking about all of this, in my head I'm thinking about the current world that we live in. And again, it's the oldest saying in the book: if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. And I look at the Russia situation, the China situation that we're in right now with Taiwan and Ukraine, and it almost seems like we're leading up to the exact same thing. I mean, you could honestly draw a complete parallel between the two.
Well, I mean, when you look at the Pacific War and you see how it played out, we had Alger Hiss, who was later identified as a Russian spy. He was actually indicted for perjury and I think spent a year or two in jail, having been convicted of perjury. But he was always suspected of being a Russian spy. Alger Hiss lived on into the 1990s. And then, as I understand it, in the early 2000s, there were Russian documents that were declassified that showed that Alger Hiss really was a Russian spy. Okay, here you had Alger Hiss, who was advising Stanley Hornbeck, who was the Far Eastern advisor to Cordell Hull, Secretary of State. So at this crucial time, when Cordell Hull was wondering what to do about this Chinese ultimatum, and he was influenced by Hornbeck, who in turn was influenced by Hiss, and we are left to wonder how much influence Hiss had on Hornbeck and Hornbeck had on Hull to produce the ultimatum to Japan, because Hiss was clearly of the view that a war between Japan and the United States would benefit Russia.
Okay.
Because that's where his sympathies lay. And if it hadn't been for Hiss and Hornbeck, we might not have delivered that ultimatum to Japan, and we might have avoided the attack on Pearl Harbor. And as it turned out, the big winner in the Far East, as these decades have unfolded, the big winner in the Far East is China, not Russia.
Mm-hmm.
China has been the big winner in the Far East, and we're facing that today.
Yeah, for
Had
sure.
Had it not been for the attack on Pearl Harbor, which would inevitably, and the Japanese knew that, in a long war with the United States, they were going to lose. And the Japanese ended up being pushed back to their home islands. They had to give up Taiwan. They had to give up Korea. They had to give up Manchuria. Were back to their home islands. And had it not been for that, the Japanese could be still a significant force in the Far East and a counterforce to China. None of that occurred because of the war between Japan and the United States. that we are facing China today making demands on Taiwan.
Yeah. We certainly are. And it's kind of it's a similar situation where we're coming out of 20 years of war, 20 years with Afghanistan and Iraq. People are tired. People don't want to hear about war. They want to put that, you know, behind us. They want to return to that that isolationist view and just take care of America. Don't worry about all these other people. So we don't want boots on the ground in these different countries. We don't want a ground war or a naval battle against China. But at the same time, we're funding, like you said, a loan and lease type situation with different countries to fight quote unquote proxy wars or whatever the case may be. So you're doing very similar. And again, Russia Ukraine is a similar situation. China Taiwan is a similar situation.
Yeah.
Everything that we did leading up to Pearl Harbor, and again, it's outside influences other than what's best for America that's kind of making the decisions. And you know, you talk about it in the book. A lot of this did not have to happen. The Pearl Harbor, if they don't attack Pearl Harbor, there's a good chance we don't go to war with Japan. You know, you can't say for sure that we wouldn't have, but there's a pretty good chance, because like you said, Japan didn't want to go to war with us. It was not in their best interest.
They were bogged down in China.
Yeah.
Losing huge amounts of troops. The Chinese were also, but the Chinese had more to lose. I mean, the Japanese were looking for a way out of China.
Mm-hmm.
They realized they were overextended.
So I have to ask you, you know, as somebody who has studied history and as somebody who has a lot of knowledge about diplomacy and strategy of geopolitics, we'll say, do you feel like we are one letter or one note away, kind of like we were back then with the Hull Note, from a war with either China or Russia? Do you feel, do you get that same kind of, perspective from the clues that we're seeing now with how we're dealing with things? Or do you think that the world has changed enough that we can avoid that?
Well, I think that power politics never ends. It starts and it continues. And it's easy to look back and in retrospect and say, well, yes, we should have avoided the war with Japan. And yes, we should never have agreed to the Chinese ultimatum. And in my book, I have one sentence which states the winner in the Far East was not Russia, but China.
Mm-hmm.
And I just end that with a period. If I were, maybe I'll do a second edition someday. If I were doing this again, I would expand on that.
Right, right.
Because that's an extremely important point, and all I did was put one sentence into it. So other people can expand on that. The fact is, the current government in China never controlled Taiwan.
No, it was Chiang Kai-shek the whole time.
It was Chiang Kai-shek, and Japan controlled Taiwan beginning in 1910, I think it was, so that Taiwan was never part of the current government of China.
And see, that's an important fact that I think people forget a lot. You know, you talk to people who haven't studied it, and the initial reaction is as well, China wants back what was theirs, but it was never theirs. It was Mao Zedong took over mainland China. Chiang Kai-shek went to Taiwan.
That's right.
And
Chiang Kai-shek went to Taiwan. And that was after the Japanese were moved out of Taiwan.
Exactly. So it was, like you said, it was never China's to own, but now they feel like it's theirs.
That's right. It was never part of the current government of China.
Right, right. Yeah, the communist, the people, the Communist Party that runs China now never ever ran Taiwan.
That's correct. And they're separate people. They're their own culture.
Mm-hmm.
Their art. It's a very different culture in many ways from mainland China.
And people don't realize how important it is to the United States. I mean, and not to get off topic of history and the book and everything, but Taiwan produces a lot of things that the United States needs, including microprocessors and things like that. Most of it is created and built in Taiwan. So don't sleep on how important Taiwan is to the United States.
That's correct. Yeah. Absolutely crucial.
Crucial. And that's why we're involved. And again, that's, I guess that's my concern is that we, if we don't look at the past and say, hey, look at what we did over here and where we ended up, maybe we should try a different tactic or look at this in a different light. Because after Pearl Harbor, it, for that first year leading up to Midway, it was not easy going for the United States back and forth with Japan. And if you would, tell me a little bit about that time frame, that year in between December 7th, 1941 and August of 1942. What was going on? What was happening in that time in the Pacific?
Well, right after Pearl Harbor, we had Wake Island, which was a disaster.
Yes.
We had the opportunity to evacuate all those people from Wake Island, didn't do it. The Marines put up a valiant defense at one point when the Japanese tried a limited invasion. The Marines beat them back. But then the Japanese came back with a major invasion. There was no way that our small contingent on Wake Island could possibly succeed against a massive invasion. And so Wake was overwhelmed. Over 1,000 people and 1,000 civilians were there as construction workers, in addition to the Marines and a few Navy personnel. They were all taken captive. They were taken back to China. They were subjected to horrible, horrible captivity. And they were there for 3¾ years.
Oh, wow.
Until finally they were liberated. Most of them survived. Some died. But the horrible conditions affected everybody. There were 97 workers left on Wake Island as slave laborers for the Japanese army to continue the building project. And then when it looked like there was an invasion coming in 1943, the Japanese army killed all of those workers. So that was Wake Island. Now, Yamamoto, the brilliant, so-called brilliant Yamamoto, after Pearl Harbor, took his fleet into the Indian Ocean to raid the British Navy, the Royal Navy around Ceylon, which now is Sri Lanka. And why did he do that? Yamamoto did not survive the war.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been to cut off supply lines that were going into the Burma Road. You may have even thought of maybe the Japanese could take over part of India. But nevertheless, he took the carrier fleet into the Indian Ocean in February, March, and they just came back in April. Meanwhile, Halsey was taking over the carrier fleet. They were making raids against Japanese islands, the Marshalls, Marcus, Rabaul that the Japanese had taken. The carriers were running ramshot over the Japanese islands. So when the Yamamoto brought the carrier fleet back into April, and two of the carriers moved into the Coral Sea, and we had the Battle of the Coral Sea.
Mm-hmm.
But meanwhile, the real battle that was gearing up was Midway. And so the Japanese lost four carriers, not sunk, but damaged and lost airplanes. So the Japanese had two carriers left out of the Midway attack. They attacked Midway with four carriers, and we had broken the Japanese code by that time. We knew they were coming. And even though we knew that, we failed in the initial execution of Midway, but later in the day of June 4th, 1942, our carrier pilots were able to pull the victory out of the jaws of defeat as the Japanese were just about ready to attack our carriers. And so we ended up winning the Battle of Midway. That was the turning point because the Japanese, having lost four carriers at Midway, had no hope of winning the Pacific War. And from then on, it was a constant battle of island by island, point by point, until we finally were able to win the war in 1945.
And it was Midway that allowed us to then move in and fight that island-to-island war, where that's the Marines right. were able Midway. To go to, like you said, Guadalcanal and right. Palelu and all those other ones that you see in the movies, you know, Pacific, the shows, and all of that kind of stuff.
That's right. Midway allowed Guadalcanal to take place.
It's amazing how one battle could, I don't know, set the stage for winning a war 3 years later. You know, it's impressive. Who was the commander or the admiral of the Navy fleet at Midway?
Well, it started out with Fletcher. Mm. And then as the battle proceeded, Fletcher was on the embarked on the Yorktown. The Yorktown was severely damaged. He had to move to a cruiser, and he put Spruance in charge of the carrier fleet at that point. And it was Spruance that devised the tactics that allowed the air group commanders of Hornet and Enterprise to operate. And it was the air group commander of Enterprise, a lieutenant commander named McCluskey, that devised the tactics that found the Japanese carriers at the last possible minute because they were running low on fuel. He was about to turn back. He saw a Japanese carrier, said, a destroyer. He said, we'll follow that. And if we don't see anything, then we've got to head back or all our airplanes are going to end up ditched in the ocean. Hmm. And at the last possible minute, they found the Japanese fleet and destroyed two carriers. The Yorktown destroyed a third. And then later in the, about 2 hours later, 3 hours later, the Enterprise planes destroyed the fourth carrier, but not before that fourth carrier put the Yorktown out of commission. It was a seesaw battle, could have gone either way.
Okay. And where was Yamamoto killed? He was killed at the Battle of Midway?
No, he was on a battleship.
Okay.
Trailing the carrier force. And as a matter of fact, in the waiting hours of the battle, with four carriers in the bottom of the ocean or sinking, all of them weren't sunk right away. Yamamoto moved up with his battleships thinking that I can still win this if I can get the American to engage in a night battle. If he could get close enough with his battleships, he could engage in a night battle and sink the carriers if he could get his battleships within range. And the interesting point there is that by that time, Spruance was in command, and some Spruance's staff officers were advising him to move west in order to be in position to launch a devastating attack against the remaining Japanese ships at first light in the morning. If he had done that, he'd have gone straight into Yamamoto's battleships. But
wow.
Spruance thought about the whole thing and he thought, look, we've sunk four Japanese carriers. That essentially wins the war. Why take further chances? And he knew the Japanese. He knew that there were at least two Japanese battleships out there. He knew they were good at night fighting. So instead of taking any chances, the big decision Spruance made was to move east. And there's a you'll see it in my book, Yamamoto's moving up through the night. His lookouts with the best night vision binoculars in the world. They were great at night fighting. They had night vision worked out far in advance of anything that anybody else had. And the lookouts were sweeping the night horizon, looking for the tiniest shape, the little pinprick of light that might indicate there was a ship over at the horizon, but there was nothing. Hmm. And by midnight, Yamamoto realized that his goal of a night battle had failed. And so he ordered the entire fleet to reverse course, and they headed back to Japan. The Battle of Midway, if you look at the history, there was pursuit for a couple of days after the June 4th. But as I state in the last line of my book is, when Admiral Spruance turned the carrier force to the east late in the day of June 4th, the Battle of Midway, for all intents and purposes, was over. And that's the last line of the book.
Excellent. Now, I have to, before we wrap everything up, I have to ask you two what I feel are important questions. One, if Pearl Harbor doesn't happen, let's play movie Hollywood for a second. And
okay.
What do you think happens if Pearl Harbor doesn't happen?
Yes.
Hitler's still doing what Hitler's doing in Europe. Yes. Roosevelt has to make decisions. What happens globally? What happens with China, Japan, and Europe?
Well, let's assume there'd be a stalemate in the Far East, mm-hmm. and Japan would eventually come to some agreement with China. The whole thing I would see as a stalemate there.
Okay.
And Japan perhaps eventually withdrawing out of China. In Europe, by one means or another, we were bound to get into a war there sooner or later. We were on our way to be, it was Operation Bolero. We were supplying troops into Britain, mm-hmm. right after Midway. And that was going to continue. I could see where we would be supplying the air war against Germany, flying from England, supplying Russia through the Persian Gulf. The Russians would eventually counterattack, and we would eventually have had a cross-channel invasion, such as we did in 1944.
Right.
It might have gone in a way similar to the way it actually happened.
In Europe, yeah.
In Europe. It's hard to say.
But Japan would have remained a major player in the Pacific.
I think Japan would have been a major player in the Pacific, and we'd have a different scene in the Pacific today.
Today. Mm-hmm. And then my last question for you, and again, this is kind of more, it's all hypothetical. What do you think the major lesson, maybe it's not hypothetical, maybe there is an exact answer. What is the major lesson learned from 1941 to 1942 for us as Americans? What is the takeaway there?
I'd say be prepared.
Okay.
We had a fleet that was, after World War I, that was largely dissipated. There were naval agreements, 1922, 1930. The major powers, Britain, United States, even France, Italy, and Japan for a while were diminishing their fleets. The Japanese in 1935 pulled out of the League of Nations. They pulled out of the agreements that they had been part of prior to that time, and they had a 5-year advantage on us, and in building their fleet. When Hitler took over France in 1940, it was the sign that, okay, this is now serious. We've got to start rebuilding. And there was the major naval bill that was put into effect in 1940. It was beginning serious rebuilding of our fleet in 1940. But it takes two or even three years for those ships to be in the fleet.
Of course.
So when Pearl Harbor occurred, we were not ready. We had aircraft carriers, three in the Pacific, four at certain times. One, we'd replace them as they got sunk. The battleships were really obsolete. They were sunk at Pearl Harbor. It was an aircraft carrier war. And it was not until the later aircraft carriers came on stream. The first were later in 1942. The first one was late in 1942. So we had actually won the Battle of Midway by the time any of those ships were present in the fleet.
It's amazing. It really is amazing. But I can't agree with you more. Being ready, being prepared for what is coming up, it's a great lesson learned from anything that we do.
Yep.
So, Dale, tell us where we could get the book, the pre-order, all that kind of stuff. I know it's available on Amazon, but please tell us where we could do all of that so that we could learn more about just an important part of our history.
All right. Well, Amazon is the immediate place orders for the book. I decided that I was not going to spend a year trying to convince an agent that he could make money off my book and who in turn could convince a publisher that they could make money off the book. I decided to go ahead with self-publishing.
Yep.
So we now live in the world of Amazon, and the books are available, an ebook, a soft cover, and there'll be hardcover available through Amazon.
Excellent. And then you said November 1st will be the start of pre-order, and then the book comes out December 1st?
December 1st, right.
Excellent. And there's a lot. It's the perfect time to pick up this book, one for Christmas gifts, all that kind of stuff, for all your history buffs out there, your World War II buffs. This is going to be a great stocking stuffer book to get them. But when you think about it, even if it's an early Christmas gift, all the things that happened in December. Civil Air Patrol established in 1941. That was December 1st. December 7th, Pearl Harbor's attacked. December 8th, war is declared on Japan. December 11th, Germany and Italy declare war on the U.S. And December 31st is the official end of World War II in 1946. So what a time to actually read the book as you're kind of going through those calendar dates. So definitely get over to Amazon, pick this book up. Again, it is Diplomats and Admirals by Dale Jenkins. Get over to Amazon November 1st for your pre-order and look for it in your mailbox on December 1st. Dale, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a blast. Like I said, I love listening to somebody talk about World War II history or just history in general. So it's been very educational, and I love what you're doing.
Okay. There's a lot of new material. It's going to be controversial in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
People like Cordell Hull, Henry Stimson are revered people in our history, and I find them at serious fault. So there's going to be some controversy about this, and also my analysis of Midway is different than what we've heard before. So it's going to be very interesting to reading for people.
I love it. No, that's great. And yeah, listen, a little controversy is good for everybody.
All right.
Well, Dale, again, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. And you have a great rest of the day.
You too. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course, sir. I want to thank Dale for coming on the show. I had a blast talking to him. as I do with most of my guests, I mean, I would say all of my guests, I always have a great time talking to them. But this was really kind of cool because it was a little bit of a different interview for me, talking about history, World War II, which is something I love to talk about. Again, like I said at the top of the show, I spent most of my elementary, middle school, and high school years sitting with my grandfather listening to stories about World War II. I mean, he loved to talk about it, and I loved to listen. And I can remember sitting on those couches still to this day, and you know, that's 30 years ago, maybe some closer to 40 years ago in some instances. And it was just very cool to sit and do that again. And now, as an adult, looking at the world through, I guess, a different lens, it is so important that we understand our history and understand where we came from, understand the mistakes that we may have made so that we don't do it again. And I think that was probably my favorite part of the interview, was looking at the parallels between our current conflicts, the proxy type wars, the more Cold War style between the United States and Russia. And then you look at what was going on with the United States and Japan prior to the start of World War II. When we talk about appeasement and we talk about, you know, sanctions, and we talk about all these different things that you hear in the news now, very similar to what was going on then. And you can see with these new documents that have been released, some new information that comes out after the fact of where what FDR actually wanted, what the Secretary of State actually was doing, all these different things. It's really interesting to see how our government makes its decisions in times of stress. I'll just leave it like that. But again, Dale, thank you so much for coming on the wall, on the show. Diplomats and Admirals, available now for pre-order. It was November 1st, was for pre-order. Go out, get it. It'll be in your mailbox December 1st. Amazon, easiest way to do it. It's great stocking stuffer for any history buff out there, any Pacific War aficionado. Go out, check out this book. I think you're really going to enjoy very new information that maybe you didn't know about previously. So please, again, that's Diplomats and Admirals by Dale Jenkins. Pre-order available now on Amazon. Book will be delivered December 1st, just in time for the holidays. Again, this week we continue just to highlight the fact that we're raising money for Hunter 7 to buy the cancer screening kits for veterans. We're upwards of over $500 now. So we're almost, our first kit is almost paid for, and we'll be moving on to our second kit. Again, goal is to get three kits for three separate veterans to be screened through the immediate need program for Hunter 7. Every dime going to them. We're using Fund the First, who have been just amazing. They've made it very simple. So you can head over to just Fund the First, type in Bulletproof Veteran. We come right up and you can donate. Please share. If you cannot donate, if times are tough and you can't spare the cash, perfectly understandable. Won't judge you at all. But if you could do us a favor and share it, maybe your neighbor or somebody you know might be interested in helping us out and raising money to kind of close out the year in a good way and give something back to Hunter 7. And they do so much for us. If you have a chance, head over to their website. Just type them in. Look at Hunter 7. I know they've been on the show. We've had them on. You can look at the interview. But you can go to their website and just see what they do on a regular basis. You can go to their Instagram and see the people that they're helping and they're raising money for and the research that they're doing and the advocacy that they're doing. These are amazing people. So that's why I kind of chose them, and I kind of latch on to what they're doing because it really speaks to me and I want to help. And again, this is my little way of helping, is doing these little fundraisers and stuff like that. So please help us out. Head over to Fund the First. Type in Bulletproof Veteran. You can also check out the link in the Instagram bio. We'll take you directly to our page, the landing page, to donate directly. It's very simple. You just type your information in, credit card, boom, boom, amount that you want to donate, and you're off. Okay, please help as much as you possibly can, and we really do appreciate it. Pre-screening is so important for cancer. The earlier that we find these cancers and we get the care that we need, the chance of survival is just it's night and day between if you find out 3-4 years after the fact, 5 years after the fact. So please, again, this is our way of trying to do that for veterans that are in need, that are at risk, toxic exposure, radiation, all these different things that we deal with, having gone to these different bases and been exposed to different things. This is how we could get out ahead of it. We want to see more and more of this. So please, again, fund the first, type in Bulletproof Veteran, donate if you can. If you can't donate, share. All right. As always, you can find us on Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, all of that. Rate the show a 5-star on your favorite podcast platform. If you're on Apple Podcasts, please leave a review. If it's Spotify, just 5-star. Boom, done. Love it. I appreciate it. Share the show with everybody that you can. We'll grow the audience. We grow the people. And we keep getting these great guests to come on because they want to talk to you. And I love it because, trust me, we're booking out all the way to the end of the year right now with some amazing guests that I think you guys are just going to love. And it's all because you listen to the show and they know that and they want to talk to you. So thank you again for doing that, sharing, all that kind of stuff. You guys are awesome out there. The Bulletproof Veteran community is by far the best. You are amazing. And I think that's it. I think that's it for this week. Again, please donate if you can. Get over to Fund the First and do that. Besides that, I think we're done, all right? For this week and for Bulletproof Veteran Podcast, my name is Jason, and thank you for your service.